Hello, listeners. Thank you for tuning into Iris today. This is the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, September 27th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Let's look at the weather forecast first thing today. This forecast coming from KCRG-TV. Fog possible early. A few showers still out there today. Expect variations in visibility this morning as fog develops in some areas. A dense fog advisory is in place for parts of the area until mid-morning, as visibility could be as low as 1/4 mile or less at times. This looks more likely in areas along and south of U.S. Highway 30. Use low beams in foggy areas, reduce speed, and allow for proper stopping distance when visibility is reduced. Fog should begin to break up by mid to late morning, and some low clouds should break up a bit along with that. As a result, partly cloudy skies will be possible by this afternoon, along with a few residual isolated showers. This is due to the influence of the same storm system that has been our main weather driver over the past few days. But it's getting farther and farther away. Thus, activity today should be even less widespread than yesterday and generally lighter. Highs reach similar levels as Tuesday in the upper 60s to low 70s. More fog is possible to kick off Thursday, potentially affecting more of the area. By later in the day, we'll wind up with partly cloudy skies, but no chance of additional rainfall. Temperatures will be a little bit higher, reaching the mid-70s. This is the start of a bigger warm-up that really takes hold into the weekend. Breezier southerly winds kick in on Friday, pushing highs into the upper 70s or low 80s. The climb continues into the weekend, with highs then easily hitting the mid-80s in many locations. For this time of year, that's 10 to 15 degrees above normal, and only a handful of degrees short of records. It comes with mostly sunny skies and dry conditions, too. Warm weather sticks around through at least the middle of next week, when our weather pattern shifts a bit to become a little more active. The first sign of this is a chance for a few showers and storms by next Wednesday, as temperatures turn only slightly cooler. Turning now to the front page, we have the weekly crop report. Large swath of Iowa fields get much-needed rain during the past week. Dateline Des Moines. A large swath of parched fields in Iowa received some much-needed rain last week, according to the Iowa Crop Progress and Condition Report released by the U.S. Department of Agriculture's National Agricultural Statistics Service. That rain reduced the days suitable for field work to 5.3 during the week ending Sunday. Field activities last week were mainly harvesting corn and soybeans. Quote, much-needed rainfall last week paused some harvesting, but will help cover crops get established while replenishing soil moisture in areas hit hard by drought, Iowa Secretary of Agriculture Mike Naig said in a news release. Warmer weather and better chances of rain are expected into early October as farmers continue to harvest as conditions allow. Topsoil moisture condition rated 27% very short, 46% short, 26% adequate, and 1% surplus. Subsoil moisture condition rated 35% very short, 44% short, and 20% adequate, and a 1% surplus. Now let's jump over to the sports section and see what local news is available there. First up is a story about UNI volleyball. Erickson nears victory number 300. Dateline Cedar Falls. The Northern Iowa soccer team pulled within one game of a 10-win mark with a 3-0 win over Southern Illinois on Sunday. The Panthers last won more than 10 games in a season in head coach Bruce Erickson's first season at the helm in Cedar Falls in 2017, as UNI went 14-5-1. That season, you and I advanced to the conference title game, falling 1-0 in the Missouri Valley Conference Championship to Missouri State. On Monday, Erickson looked back on 2017 and said the Panthers' record spoke to a strong showing in the non-conference, going 7-1-1, but also to the parity of the MVC that season. Erickson, however, described the 2017 Panthers and 2023 Panthers as very different squads. Quote, getting to 10 wins that year showed us that we could play with anybody, Erickson said, and ultimately we did. That year, we had a lot of success. This year, we are just scoring goals. Teams that have the ability to score goals play a little bit different. When you are playing ahead versus playing when the game is tied or behind is a whole different deal, like it is in any sport, but especially in soccer, unquote. Whereas the 2017 team needed wins to gain confidence, Erickson described his current team as an already confident bunch, though he noted that their best is still on the horizon. Quote, this is a group that is really confident, Erickson said. When I look back to the 2017 group, we definitely played one of our best games at the end. But we had a lot of really good games. Sunday was a really good game for us. I felt like we were in control, played a lot of players, but I still feel like we have not played our best game. Quote, we are hopeful that we can pull that out and continue to peak here later. I like the group, just a confident group that I still do not think realizes how good they can be, unquote. UNI gets its bye this week with no Thursday contest before facing Indiana State on Sunday at 12 p.m. Quote, a big week ahead, Erickson said. Sunday is a big home game against Indiana State. Our first four are teams that we tied last year. Obviously dropping the first one to Drake, but coming back and getting two wins and setting ourselves up for a big game on Sunday to get almost to the halfway point with another win would be great. That is what we are working towards, unquote. In addition to being their 10th on the season, the next UNI win would mark Erickson's 300th career victory. Erickson racked up 247 wins during stops at Creighton and Wayne State. Since joining UNI, Erickson has won 52 games as the Panthers head coach with a 52-44-18 record in Cedar Falls. Of the looming achievement, Erickson said it just means that he has had, quote, a lot of good afternoon and evenings over the last 30 seasons. Quote, it's a nice club to be part of, Erickson said. You do this long enough, hopefully you win more than you lose. The funny thing is that I am not concerned with how many I get, but the interesting thing is you pretty much remember them all. You remember a lot of the losses, too. Every win is enjoyable. Overall, Erickson's career record is 299-232-60. Volleyball starts 2-0, readies for a pair of fast MVC teams. The UNI volleyball team started off its MVC state with a pair of wins with sweeps of Bradley and Illinois State on the road. Head coach Bobby Peterson described the Bradley match as, quote, a little unique, saying the Panthers felt off from the start of the contest. Quote, what I mean by that is we had some uncharacteristic things going on, Peterson said. Communication was a problem for us, which usually it is not. One of the things we talked about as coaching staff is, how much do you address it? Because it is very uncharacteristic, some of the things that were going on. There were a lot of things we prepared for, and they came out with some things that were completely different that we had not seen. It took us a little while to adapt to that. Against Illinois State, the Panthers fared much better, according to Peterson, putting together one of their more efficient and effective offensive nights. Quote, we hit a really high percentage, Patterson said. We were very balanced. We had several kids who were very effective, which is great to see. As a team, the Panthers hit .344 for the match and hit over 300 in every set in the Redbirds, which marked the first such instance this season for you and I. Peterson said the Panthers need to improve their block ahead of matchups with Valparaiso and Illinois-Chicago this weekend, and called it an area of focus for this week. Quote, what our block does makes it harder or easier for what our backcourt is able to do, Patterson said. We talk about being good and physical, not leaving holes, not floating, not leaving gaps. For us to be able to do that, we have to be very efficient with our movement. We have to hit our game plans and just make sure we are taking away space, getting good touches or good touch blocks. The Panthers host Valpo Beacons on Friday at 6 p.m. and UIC on Saturday at 6 p.m. Next in UNI tennis, in their second competition of the season, the UNI women's tennis team saw mixed results, the Bulldog Classic in Des Moines, over the weekend. Lorena Cardoso and Darta Deleca finished as runners-up in the black and white flights, respectively, winning their first two matches before falling in the flight championship. Andra Hanna Brekic fell in her first match, but won the final two to also finish the weekend 2-1. In doubles, Brekic and Kim Zizek went 2-1. The duo's two wins were the only two by any of the Panthers' three pairings on the weekend. UNI head coach Chris Sagers called doubles play an obvious area of focus for the Panthers moving forward. Quote, we just constantly need work on doubles, Sagers said. Same story. At the Golfer Invite last weekend, we finished the first day without a doubles win. That was frustrating. We squeaked out a couple of wins, but three or four doubles wins only all weekend out of 18 total matches. That just does not cut it. We need to work on doubles. Quote, I think we are really solid singles players, and we like to rally a lot from the baseline. We can kind of do that all day. But doubles is big serves, big returns, being aggressive at the net, unquote. In the swim and dive season to open, the UNI swim and dive team begins its season with the purple and gold intra-squad meet on Saturday. The Panthers will face off at 11 a.m. in the Wellness and Recreation Services Center. Now in high school baseball, Dateline Boone. With renovations to the University of Iowa's Duane Banks Field set to be in full swing, the Iowa High School Athletic Association announced the Class 3A and 4A state baseball championships will be played in Cedar Rapids in 2024. The IHSAA board approved the move to Veterans Memorial Stadium Friday. The 5,300-seat home of the Cedar Rapids Colonels of the Midwest League was selected through a summer bidding process. The one-year agreement follows three seasons at Duane Banks Field in Iowa City for the larger school classes. When IHSAA and University of Iowa added a three-year agreement in 2022, potential renovations at Duane Banks Field made the extension year-to-year. Upgrades are scheduled to begin on the UI campus following the NCAA season in 2024. Quote, we're excited to be in Cedar Rapids in 2024 with an excellent facility, staff, and community welcoming our schools and student athletes. IHSAA Assistant Director and Baseball Administrator Andy Umtham said, quote, we sincerely appreciate this competitive bidding process, which shows the commitment that several Iowa communities and ballparks have to high school baseball in our state, unquote. Cedar Rapids most recently hosted the summer IHSAA state baseball tournament in 1974. Per the 2022 facility extensions, Carroll will again host Class 2A and Class 1A in 2024. The tournament is scheduled for July 22nd through the 26th in the year 2024. And for our final sports story, we go to high school football. Defensive plays turn tide for Cedar Falls. Gerdes scores rushing touchdown and picks off two passes. Story written by Ethan Petrick, and the dateline is Cedar Falls. Opportunistic defenses and turnovers ruled the day as Cedar Falls dealt Linmar its third loss of the season in a sloppy 33-21 win on Friday night. The Lions and Tigers combined for three fumbles, four interceptions, and three turnovers on downs during the contest. Following the win, Cedar Falls head coach Brad Remmert said he liked the fight his team showed in a game that offered both positives and things to work on. Quote, "When you go look at film, there is going to be some real positives tomorrow," Remmert said. "But there is going to be some things that we can clean up. You like to get the momentum the last 2 weeks, getting the wins here home in the dome. You have to protect your turf. Now, we have to go get something done on the road." Cedar Falls failed to find the end zone in the first quarter, but a Drew Gerdes interception in the first frame set up the Tigers' opening scoring. Cedar Falls capitalized on the turnover with a scoring drive capped by a one-yard run from running back Drake Gelhus to put the Tigers ahead 7-6 with 8 minutes 34 seconds to go in the second quarter. Cale Harms pushed the lead to 10-6 with a 37-yard goal after a bad snap on fourth down caused Linmar to turn the ball over on downs on its own 22-yard line. The Tigers wasted no time in pulling away in the second half, scoring 10 points in the first 6 minutes of the third quarter. A 33-yard field goal and a 19-yard Gelhus touchdown run, set up by another Gerdes interception, gave Cedar Falls a 20-6 lead with 6 minutes 29 seconds remaining in the third. Linmar rallied with 15 unanswered points to take the lead, however. A strip sack by Sam Watts and a Brody Pata pick six power the Lions rally. Cedar Falls steadied itself after the Lions rally and managed to score off a Tristan Fober forced fumble and Linmar turnover on downs. Gerdes gave Cedar Falls back the lead with a 6-yard touchdown run following the Fober fumble to give the Tigers a 26-21 advantage with 4 minutes remaining. William Remmert put the final nail in the coffin less than 1 minute later with a 23-yard touchdown on a reverse to the right. Drew Gerdes did it all for the Tigers on Friday night. The linebacker and running back scored once on the ground and came up with two interceptions on defense to power the Tigers on both sides of the ball. Prior to the season, Remmert said Gerdes possessed that kind of a talent as a potential impact player for the Cedar Falls, and the senior showcased his myriad abilities against Linmar. Quote, "He's a solid player in all facets of the game," Remmert said. Quote, "We just have to be careful how many snaps we play him. In week two, he played 110 snaps, but he's doing fantastic for us. Those interceptions were huge, getting us field position, getting us momentum, and shutting down their drives," unquote. Gerdes's two interceptions, both of which resulted in touchdowns, were the result of the superstar's preparation. Quote, "We have not been very good the last two times on the road. We got to get that solved. That is my job. I have to figure out how to get this team locked in so we go down in the first quarter and play really, really well on the road," unquote. All In Grocers grand opening planned for October 3rd. Dateline Waterloo. The grand opening of the All-in-One Grocers and Grandma's Hands restaurant is set for noon on October 3rd. A ribbon cutting will be held at the store location, 221 Franklin Street. Commemorative grocery bags will be offered to attendees, along with food samples from the new restaurant. The 28,000-square-foot development also includes clean laundry and Willie Mae Wright Community Center, named after the Waterloo Civil Rights icon. The center will not only host cooking, math, science, and history classes, but serve as a satellite office of the 1619 Freedom School, an after-school program focused on literacy founded by Nicole Hannah-Jones, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist from Waterloo. The center will also include space for Road Home, a nonprofit fiscally sponsored by the American Family Insurance Institute for corporate and social impact that will provide re-entry services to the formerly incarcerated. The project received help from Rochdale Capital, IFF, a nonprofit community development financial institution, the American Family Insurance Institute, True Stage Foundation, formerly known as CUNA Mutual, and Self-Help Credit Union. The City of Waterloo has also provided support for All-In Grocers. More information can be found at allingrocers.com. Waterloo woman charged with 8 counts in strawman firearms indictment. Dateline Waterloo. A Waterloo woman has been charged in an apparent strawman scheme to buy firearms. On Tuesday, the court unsealed an indictment charging LaDonna Henderson, 27, with 8 counts of making a false statement in a firearm purchase and 1 count of drug user in possession of a firearm. Also charged in the indictment is Christopher Martez Hoover, 36, who is charged with 1 count of being a prohibited person in possession of a firearm. Hoover was detained by Waterloo police on Monday. The government is also seeking forfeiture of the guns recovered during the investigation. Court records allege Henderson bought 8 guns from 2 licensed gun dealers between November 2022 and June of 2023, sometimes buying similar models just days apart. She allegedly falsely indicated she wasn't a drug user and was buying the guns for herself, according to court records. Authorities allege 6 of the firearms, a 9mm Taurus G2C pistol, a 9mm Taurus G2S pistol, a 9mm Carr CW9 pistol, a .22 caliber Heritage Rough Rider revolver, and a 9mm Smith & Wesson SD9 pistol, and a 9mm Glock 48 pistol, were purchased for other people, records indicate. Henderson and Hoover are charged with possession of the other 2 guns, a .22 caliber Heckler and a Hoch 416D rifle, and a 9mm Ruger LC9S pistol. Hoover is prohibited from handling firearms because of prior felony drug and theft convictions, according to the court record. 9 area residents accused of fraud in the COVID-19 relief program. Story filed by Jeff Reinitz. Dateline Waterloo. A federal grand jury has issued indictments against 9 area residents alleging COVID-19 relief fraud. The charges say the defendants gamed the system designed to offer economic relief during the coronavirus pandemic. Court records allege the 9 submitted false information when applying for the Small Business Administration loans. In some cases, they are accused of inaccurately reporting their business's gross income on the loan applications, authorities allege. In other cases, authorities say the businesses never existed. Those charged with wire fraud include Tia Lynette Cole Sykes, who operated a daycare business and received a $19,790 wire transfer through the program. She allegedly falsely reported her gross income for 2020, according to court records. And Keisha Ann Mormon received $19,835 for a daycare business. Mormon allegedly reported her business made $95,210 in income in 2019, but court records allege she didn't operate a daycare business in 2019. Orenthal James Jones received $20,832 for long-distance specialized trucking. He allegedly claimed his business made $105,000 in 2020, but court records say he didn't earn any income from a trucking company that year. Stacy Antoinette Cole received $20,332 for a retail store. She allegedly indicated her business had a monthly payroll of $8,133 with $100,000 in gross income in 2019. But court records say the business didn't exist. She then spent the funds on other things and applied to have the loan forgiven, court records state. Reed Jonathan Gertz received $19,166 for a construction material wholesale business. He allegedly claimed a gross income of $92,000 in 2020, but court records allege he didn't operate a construction wholesale business. Ida Mae Roby, a retail store operator, received $20,833. She allegedly falsely reported her gross income for 2019, according to court records. Allure Shapri Roby, a beauty salon operator, received $20,832. She allegedly falsely reported her gross income for 2020, according to court records. Shala Charisse Cole, who operates a daycare business, received $20,415. She allegedly falsely reported her gross income for 2019, according to court records. And lastly, Sheila Renee Cole received $19,583 for personal services. She allegedly falsely reported her gross income for 2020, according to court records. Two homes damaged in overnight gunfire. Dateline Waterloo. Two homes were hit by gunfire in an overnight shooting on Wednesday. Sheriff's deputies were on patrol when they heard gunshots in the area of Vinton Avenue around 11:30 p.m. Wednesday. Authorities found a number of spent shell casings in the area. They also found damage to a home at 724 Vinton Street. Police said the house has been the target of recent gunfire previously, but residents observed fresh damage. Bullets also struck a rear glass door to a house at 424 Florence Avenue nearby, police said. No injuries were reported, and no arrests have been made. UNI's Upward Bound program gives high school students an opportunity to experience college. Dateline Cedar Falls. High school students have numerous ways to explore college options today. They can talk with school counselors, visit campuses, or even watch a new video series called The College Tour to do a deeper dive into colleges across the country. But how about actually living on campus for an extended period of time to get a taste of what it's like to be away from home and attend classes there? UNI has answered that call with its Upward Bound College preparatory programming. The state university gave close to 100 Waterloo High School students the chance to live in dorms for 5 weeks this summer and go to classes. It is the first year of the residential opportunity since the COVID-19 pandemic. Quote, we look at their four-year plans for what classes they would like to take next school year, and then we put them in classes during the summer to prepare them for what they're going to see in the coming year, said Sarah Cohen, director of Upward Bound Math and Science. Their lives as college students include the everyday rigors outside the classroom, too. That means lots of walking around campus to get to the buildings where classes are being taught. They eat meals with students they've never met, an experience similar to that of a first-year college student. Quote, this program is a great opportunity to expand the circle of people you hang out with, said Orton Frederick, who will be an 11th grader at West High School in the fall. Quote, I feel this program really helped me open up a bit more, unquote. They pick up soft skills, too. Many of the students agreed time management is a skill they had to learn while in the program. Quote, I was impressed with how college students manage their time well. It gets stressful at times because you realize you got all these things to do, said Caden Moore, who will be a 9th grader at East High School in the fall. Students took classes like algebra, biology, and reading comprehension, and experienced a changing schedule every day. Quote, I had algebra 2 for math, and I'm going into algebra 2. My teacher would explain the basic concepts, and we would just practice them over and over. It really gave me the instruction I needed so I wouldn't fall behind in math classes, said Rana Takey, a West High School student heading into 10th grade. Quote, you don't have to get warmed up to learn a subject like math, and you can go straight into it next year, she added. Specifically, Frederick, Moore, and Techie are part of the Upward Bound Math and Science program, which helps students each week recognize and develop their potential to excel in different careers. Quote, they are actually our very first cohort of students to be in Upward Bound Math and Science, and then to be on campus, said Cohen. Quote, a lot of students had their minds set on careers, but they learned a lot about other ones throughout the summer as they were exposed to STEM careers on campus and went to other colleges. The activities were really great as introductions. In the future, I'd really like the older students to dive a bit deeper into the careers that they're most interested in and work more hands-on with the professors in those careers at the university, unquote. The careers range from healthcare and accounting to engineering. What they learned each week wasn't just about what those professions do on a regular basis. It introduced the students to what's needed to enter the fields. Quote, I'd like to go to UNI to get my physics degree, said Fredericks. That's what engineers typically have to get, unquote. Moore described her experience as positive learning and like a summer camp for STEM enthusiasts. Techie reflected on her experience with metalworking while in the program. Quote, casting metal and controlling the excavator was really fun, Techie said. Additionally, the students had other fun experiences outside the classroom and went on a one-week road trip, Classroom on the Road, as part of the program. They visited St. Louis to learn about what St. Louis University and the University of Missouri-St. Louis offer. Quote, there are scholarships, and I learned about how colleges offer a lot of help along the way, said Tyne Chappelle, who will be an 11th grader at West High. Upward Bound has a goal of expanding education opportunities for disadvantaged communities and supports students in many ways. Other services include tutoring, student application assistance, scholarship support, and ACT preparation. And now, listeners, we just want to take a moment to remind you that you're listening to the recording of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, September 27th on IRIS, I-R-I-S. That's the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. And now, this announcement.
Tom is a hero. Has he saved someone from a fire? Or rescued someone from drowning? No, but he still saved a life. Because when Tom was worried that his friend Josh was thinking about suicide, he asked him about it. You don't have to be a firefighter or lifeguard to save a life. You just have to ask. If you don't know what to say, visit yourlifeiowa.org right away. We can help you help those you care about. Brought to you by the Iowa Department of Public Health.
And now, let's turn to the opinion section. Our first editorial was printed in the Des Moines Register, titled, Cooperating on Water is the Best Future for Central Iowa. And this was written by Andrea Bolton and Sue Huppert. As our region grows, it is vitally important our Central Iowa communities work together to plan for the water needs of the future. Our city founders recognized the availability of water was pivotal in developing a thriving community. Today, the Board of Waterworks Trustees for Des Moines Waterworks is thankful for this foresight and recognize we are at another potentially historic crossroads for ensuring a safe, sufficient, and affordable water supply for future generations. For more than 5 years, city leaders and those appointed to the various water boards have worked together to create a transformative regional governance entity known as Central Iowa Waterworks, or CIWW. potential founding members, including Des Moines Water Works, the Urbandale Water Utility, and West Des Moines Water Works, along with community water departments, independent water works, and rural water districts, are considering the agreement that establishes the CIWW. Our region has a proud history of collaboratively and cooperatively managing water resources. Des Moines Water Works has proactively worked with its suburban partners since DMWW's first regional agreement in 1934, when Urbandale contracted with DMWW to supply its water. After the 1993 flood, suburban partners contributed $100 million to build additional water treatment plants and facilities that DMWW owns and operates for the benefit of the region. Today, suburban communities use more than 50% of the water produced by DMWW. Des Moines Water Works takes seriously the responsibility of being the regional drinking water provider. Our customer base has expanded to 600,000 Central Iowans, one-fifth of Iowa's population. With more than 100 years of history, we at DMWW are proud of the role we have played. Ensuring safe and affordable water is available in the future requires us to strengthen the partnerships DMWW has with suburban communities. CIWW is the best path forward. Regional collaboration provides the best management of water resources, now and in the future. Under a regional model, CIWW members will collaborate on decisions to expand or build treatment plants and secure water resources, and will plan regionally for treatment and production to avoid costly, unneeded duplication of infrastructure. Regional cooperation ensures fair and equitable sharing of financial responsibilities. Today, Des Moines residents account for 40% of water sales, yet assume 100% of the risk. Under CIWW, all members would manage and govern a regional system, thereby sharing risk more equitably. Regional collaboration builds a stronger, more resilient system. The flood of 1993 proved resiliency is imperative in providing drinking water. Our system has made sufficient improvements since 1993 with the addition of two treatment plants. However, CIWW will create a metro-wide system that connects all members' facilities to a single network to safeguard against natural disasters. It provides resiliency in times of drought, water quality challenges, and unforeseen threats to water in the years ahead. Importantly, the Des Moines Water Works Board of Trustees will continue to serve its customers. The DMWW Board will set water rates for its customers. DMWW will operate and maintain its local distribution system, mains and water towers, and customer service will be handled by DMWW employees. We are very excited about this plan for our region. We believe the years of hard work and dedication of the elected officials, board members, and staff of our various communities involved in this process have positioned Des Moines Water Works and the citizens of Des Moines well for the future. Central Iowa Water Works establishes shared regional governance to ensure our most vital natural resource is protected and available as Central Iowa grows. The people of Des Moines are not selling their regional water utility. They are joining with their neighbors to strengthen the one we have. By coming together, sharing risks, and planning together, we will be better prepared to face the challenges of tomorrow. Regionalization isn't a dismantling of a great water utility. Regionalization is the way our water utility positions itself for the future. Next, from the New York Times, we have The Parable of the Squirrel-Planted Pumpkins, written by Margaret Renkel. And the column begins with a photograph of a little free library and a wooden bench, and it's surrounded by pumpkin vines. Here's the text. Pecans were a cash crop for my grandparents, who supplemented their unreliable farm income in any way they could. My grandfather drove the school bus. My grandmother taught math. Unlike peanuts, the farm's primary crop, pecans required no planting and almost no care, and they paid out every year so long as someone picked them up before the squirrels got there first. That's where my siblings and cousins and I came in. I was astonishingly old before I learned that pumpkins are food. It would never have occurred to my grandmother to put a pumpkin pie on her Thanksgiving table. In the lower Alabama of my youth, fall celebrations meant pecan pie topped with vanilla ice cream. Pumpkins were for jack-o'-lanterns. That all changed thanks to the squirrels in South Carolina. The first year I was in graduate school there, a vine with large, squash-like leaves popped up in my raised beds. I was new enough to gardening to think that it might be some variety of watermelon, so I let it stay. The vine produced great yellow flowers, which intoxicated the bees, and in due time the flowers shriveled and fell off, revealing a bumper crop of round green fruits. Sugar babies! Alas, no. They were no kind of watermelon, much less the treasured sugar baby. They were small, dense pie pumpkins, apparently planted by the neighborhood squirrels. One Saturday, I sent a whole pie home with every member of my writer's group and still had enough pies left over for my neighbors. Fast forward to 2021, when pumpkins of all sizes and varieties started appearing on Nashville porch railings, piling up beside front doors, cascading down brick steps. It looked as though a drunk giant had been staggering around suburbia all night, vomiting pumpkins. This, I learned, is what happens when decorative trends from the cozy sweater region of the country reach the sleeveless blouse region of the country. Behold the autumnal porchscapes of New England, shaded by Tennessee trees, still green with summer. Porch decor is not a big priority at this house. Now that our children are grown, my husband and I don't even get around to carving a jack-o'-lantern most years. So I didn't give the porchscapes a lot of thought until holiday decorations began to replace them. On garbage day, the curbside bins were suddenly overflowing with pumpkins, and I hated to see all that food go to waste. I have reached the age of not caring a whit about whether other people think I've lost my mind. I liberated as many of those garbage can pumpkins as I could carry and set them in the scraggly area at the back of our lot. Except for planting native trees and shrubs, it's never a good idea to feed wild animals. But I made an exception for the porchscape pumpkins. In a hungry time, a lot of creatures love a pumpkin. Not just squirrels and chipmunks, but also raccoons and opossums and skunks, foxes and coyotes, even turtles and a fair number of birds. Which is why, when the porchscape pumpkins reappeared last year, I mentioned in our neighborhood WhatsApp thread that our wild neighbors would appreciate the leftovers once pumpkin season was over. I thought I was gently suggesting that each family could save their discarded pumpkins for their own, other than human neighbors, to enjoy. Then pumpkins started arriving every day on the bench beside our little free library as my sweet neighbors delivered donations to the wildlife sanctuary that is our half-acre lot. I moved the pumpkins to the backyard as quickly as I could. If I dawdled, the squirrels would climb right up on the bench and dig in. By December, pumpkin vines were springing up all over the yard, in the little meadow on the side of our house, in the deep shade out back, in the flower bed surrounding the little free library itself. All fall, the squirrels had been hiding pumpkin seeds, storing up for winter. But winter was elusive last year, as it seems destined to be every year in this human-warmed world, and the warmth had stretched out long enough for those seeds to germinate. Instead of storing pumpkin seeds, the squirrels were planting them. Winter did come eventually, and the young pumpkin vines died with the first frost. I thought that was the end of them. I was wrong. Come May, more pumpkin vines popped up in the flower bed, and this time summer was on their side. The vines grew and grew and spread, spilling down our driveway the way their parents had once spilled down my neighbor's front steps. Pumpkin vines curled around the mailbox and climbed the bench. When the pumpkins emerged, some of them ripened right on the street. Neighborhood children started paying daily visits, checking on their progress. I began to reconsider the tale of Jack and his beanstalk. Would a giant be coming in the night? Quote, "The pumpkin has a boo-boo," a neighborhood three-year-old told me one day. When I bent to see what she meant, I saw there were a small set of powerful incisors had conducted a taste test, just barely scratching the surface of the rind. Long before I could have guessed it was time to pick a pumpkin, the squirrels who planted them in the first place had come back to claim their crop. One of the pumpkins began to look exactly like the undead version of a jack-o'-lantern. The pumpkin vines, despite being colonized by powdery mildew, are still blooming, and baby green pumpkins are still appearing where the blooms fall off. But already, new pumpkin vines are erupting all over the yard, a squirrel-perpetuating ecosystem. For an entire year, I have taken great joy from watching squirrels return the neighborhood porchscape pumpkins to their original purpose, in the process feeding their own neighbors in this scruffy habitat. I like to think the squirrel-planted pumpkins in my flower bed as an example, writ small, of how the natural world once worked before we interrupted it with our poisons and our machines. How it can still work, even in our built landscapes, if only we would let it. And much like my grandparents' pecan trees, this harvest requires no work of us and almost no care. I recognize the forces arrayed against this hopeful view of the scorching habitat we call home. Who doesn't know them by now? They weigh on me with the force of a giant's foot pressing me to the hot ground. Hope wells up anyway, God help me. I look at the squirrel-ravaged pumpkins next to our little free library, and my whole heart brims with hope. The author here, Margaret Renkle, is a contributing opinion writer and the author of books Graceland at Last and Late Migrations. Her next book, The Comfort of Crows, A Backyard Year, will be published in October. And next, with my apologies, is an article about the current stalemate on the budget in Congress in Washington, D.C. The title is Soft Corruption and the Limits of Populism. It was written by Paul Krugman of the New York Times. There are currently two clown shows, sorry, but let's be honest, going on in the Republican Party. One is the intra-party fighting that seems extremely likely to cause a government shutdown a few days from now. The other is the fight over who will come a distant second to Donald Trump in the presidential primaries. There are many strange aspects to both shows, but here's the one that has long puzzled me. Everyone says that with the rise of MAGA has been taken over by populists. So why is the Republican Party's economic ideology so elitist and anti-populist? Listen to the rhetoric of the people making Kevin McCarthy look like a fool, or of the presidential candidates, and it's full of attacks on elites, but also of promises to cut taxes for the rich and slash government spending that benefits the working class. For example, Nikki Haley, who is making a credible bid to be Trump's also-ran, given Ron DeSantis's implosion, is calling for big cuts to Social Security and Medicare. As I write this, McCarthy is reportedly trying to appease MAGA descendants with a temporary funding bill that would cut non-military discretionary spending outside of Veterans Affairs by 27%, meaning savage cuts to things like the administration of Social Security, as opposed to the benefits themselves. The thing is, such proposals are deeply unpopular. It's true that Americans tell pollsters that the government spends too much, but if you ask them about specific types of spending, the only area on which they say we spend too much is foreign aid, which is a trivial part of the budget. Oh, and most Americans still support aid to Ukraine. So there would seem to be an opening for politicians who are right-wing on social issues like immigration and wokeness, but also are genuinely populist in their spending priorities. Such politicians exist in other countries. For example, Giorgia Meloni, the Italian prime minister, whose party has deep links to the nation's fascist past, ran last year on a platform calling for earlier retirement for some workers and increases in minimum pensions and child benefits. So why aren't there such figures in the GOP? To be fair, during the 2016 campaign, Trump sometimes sounded as if he might turn his back on Republican economic orthodoxy. But once in office, he pursued the usual agenda of tax cuts for corporations and the wealthy, combined with benefit cuts for the rest. Part of the answer may lie in the America Right's general mindset, which valorizes harshness, not empathy. People who are drawn to MAGA tend to imagine that solving society's problems should involve punishing people, not helping them. Also, we shouldn't underestimate the power of ignorance. MAGA politicians, who generally disdain any kind of expertise, may not have any clear idea of what the federal government does and where tax dollars go. Finally, there's the Clarence Thomas factor. What I mean is that part of the explanation for the absence of genuine Republican populists may involve the gravitational pull of big money, which is both broader and subtler than the way it's often portrayed. If the accusations against Senator Robert Menendez are true, and it's not looking good, old-fashioned bribery, payments to politicians in exchange for favors, hasn't gone away, but it's probably not shaping party ideology. Campaign contributions, on the other hand, definitely do shape ideology. DeSantis was touted as a rival to Trump because he got a lot of support from big donors who believed he would serve their interests and had real political skills. Being rich doesn't necessarily come with good judgment. But there's a sort of gray area that doesn't involve outright bribes in the sense of money given in return for specific actions, but nonetheless involves a form of soft corruption. For the fact is that public figures whom the very rich see as being on their side can reap considerable personal rewards from their positions. Recent revelations about Justice Thomas show how this works. ProPublica reports that he has received many favors from ultra-wealthy conservatives, notably lavish free vacations. These reports are shocking because we don't expect such behavior from a Supreme Court justice, and Thomas may have violated the law by failing to disclose these gifts. But does anyone doubt that many politicians who favor tax cuts for the rich and reduced benefits for the working class, even as they rail against elites, receive similar favors? And the hermetic information space of the American right surely facilitates this soft corruption. Suggestions of improper influence on right-wing officials and politicians won't get much coverage on Fox News, except possibly for claims that they're the victims of a liberal smear campaign. Now, I don't know how important these different factors are to the fact that Americans' populists are anything but populist in practice, but we do need to ask why people who denounce elites somehow always manage to avoid targeting corporations not named Disney and billionaires not named George Soros. Now back to local news from the Courier. Waterloo Schools hires interim associate superintendent for the coming year. Dateline Waterloo. The Waterloo Community Schools has hired Sue Alborn Yillick as interim associate superintendent for the 2023-24 school year. Her professional background includes an emphasis in e-learning, K-12 education, literacy, educational technology, and instructional design. She has a doctorate in Educational Leadership and Policy Studies from the Iowa State University and has been an educator for 4 decades. She retired in 2019 after 4 years as a University of Northern Iowa assistant professor, according to her LinkedIn page. She coordinated the Principal Preparation Program during her time at UNI in Cedar Falls. Since 2017, she has also worked as a self-employed executive leadership consultant. Previously, Alborn Yilik held Director of Human Resources positions for the Bettendorf Community School District from 2010 to 2015 and the North Scott Community School District in Eldridge from 2010 to 2013. From 2005 to 2010, she was Director for the Education Office of Special Programs at the University of Wisconsin, Platteville. Waterloo Schools underwent a hiring process in the spring for the position of Associate Superintendent before deciding to bring in Alborn Yilik on an interim basis. Quote, she has been in education for 43 years and has coached countless principals and districts during her illustrious career. Superintendent Jared Smith said in a news release, quote, she is uniquely qualified to contribute to our forward momentum as a district in support of our staff, students, and district goals. And now, listeners, that's going to do it for today's reading of the Waterloo-Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, September 27th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Remember, you can access a recording of this reading of the Courier or of the other newspapers around the state that we record. Just go to our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And we want to thank you for listening to your IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.